Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a reaction to the outbursts of Islamophobia on Fox News and elsewhere in response to the Boston bombings. Amjad Mahmoud Khan, who is the National Director of Public Affairs for the Ahmadiyya Muslim Community, joins us. He has testified three times before the Tom Lantos Human Rights Commission at the U.S. House of Representatives about persecution of religious minorities in the Islamic world, and we will discuss the backlash America's Muslims are experiencing to the bombings. Then we'll speak with Middle East expert Juan Cole, who writes the popular blog Informed Comment at juancole.com. where he has an article, Terrorism and Other Religions, in which he compares the casualties of political violence in the 20th century, where Muslims killed 2 million people compared to Christian Europeans who killed 100 million. We will discuss further the backlash of Islamophobia against American Muslims who live in a country where murder rates are sky high compared to those in the Muslim world. Then finally, we will examine the collapse of an 8-story building in Bangladesh that killed up to 90 low-wage garment workers making clothes for European and U.S. high-end brands. Charles Kernighan, who is the Executive Director of the Institute for Global Labor and Human Rights, joins us to discuss this latest in a series of fatal accidents in the world's second biggest garment exporter and the anti-sweatshop movement in the U.S. that he has launched. And joining us now is Amjad Mahmoud Khan, who is the National Director of Public Affairs for the Ahmadiyya Muslim Community. He's a frequent lecturer on the Islamic world, human rights, law, and governance. His writings have appeared in the Harvard Human Rights Law Journal, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, Christian Science Monitor, and the New York Daily News. A lawyer based in Los Angeles, he has testified three times before the Tom Lantos Human Rights Commission at the United States House of Representatives about the persecution of religious minorities in the Islamic world. Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Amjad Mahmoud Khan.
Thanks for having me.
And clearly, since the Boston bombings, at least the two perpetrators have been revealed, and every day there's more and more indications that at least the older brother was radicalized, although the younger brother has just said that they were acting more out of their upset over U.S. foreign policy, particularly what was happening in Iraq and Afghanistan. There was no question that the older brother was radicalized in his Islamic beliefs to the point where at the local mosque he was disruptive. But on the other side, of course, we've had this rash of Islamophobia that's come out before, after, and during this event. So as a Muslim, how are you feeling at the moment?
Well, Ian, it's a very difficult time, and there are complicated facts here. But, you know, on one hand, I feel sort of how I felt the days after the September 11th attacks. I was actually those were my first days at Harvard Law School. It was 10 days into law school when those attacks happened. At that time, there was very little knowledge by mainstream Americans about Islam, and the attacks happened, and I was just shocked because as an American Muslim who grew up in the United States, it was painful to, of course, just as with all Americans, to see such a heinous attack in such dramatic form, and then I was doubly pained because it was committed by those who purported to be Muslim. This past week was difficult. I mean, I've been in those streets in Cambridge. I spent 3 years of my life there. I know those neighborhoods. Boston is a very strong city. Cambridge is a very strong and vibrant city. These individuals, when it was revealed that they were the alleged perpetrators, I felt sad. I knew that there would be some, renewed backlash against Muslims and against Islam because of the backgrounds of these gentlemen. But at the same time, I feel like we've come a long way since the attacks of September 11th. I think that it's true that Islamophobia may be on the rise, but I think the general understanding of Islam is much more improved than it was 10 years ago. And I think the vast majority of Americans understand that it's wrong to scapegoat, it's wrong to stereotype, and they can differentiate and disassociate, decouple the acts of these two individuals, which were nefarious, from the faith itself, which is followed by you know, over a billion people.
Well, of course, we have the example of a recent incident that was apparently avoided in Canada, where a couple of radicals had planned on blowing up a train in Canada, and they were actually informed on by the Muslim community in Canada because they were seen as having become radical. So what happened at the mosque where the older brother had these outbursts over Martin Luther King being mentioned? He was clearly out of step with his congregation because they apparently censured him. But my understanding is that he was radicalized by somebody who's called Misha, somebody in Cambridge that he knew who is apparently of Armenian descent. So I'm trying to get a picture on the journey this fellow took in the name of Islam into an area that, of course, is causing you, as a Muslim, a lot of chagrin and backlash.
Right. I mean, as a lawyer, I'm always weary of making sure, you know, the facts are, you know, verified, and I'm not certain of the impetus behind the change in Tamerlan Tsarnaev, and clearly something changed within him over time, and his 6 month journey and overseas perhaps influenced his change and certainly his hold on his younger brother. I don't know who in Cambridge, or if anyone in Cambridge who is a Muslim, was responsible for this change. What we do know is that he did have, it is verified that he did have a shouting match at a Jummah Friday service in Cambridge, and it was very intriguing because I think the imam who was giving the sermon was talking about emulating the life and teachings of Martin Luther King and perhaps drawing some analogies to the Prophet Muhammad. And he immediately stood up in the middle of the sermon, which is, you know, most Muslims know is just, you know, breaching all etiquette, and shouting down the imam as saying that we shouldn't emulate this man and it's hypocritical to compare him with the Prophet Muhammad. So there was some type of an incident there. And, the way I see this is that, you know, I'm very particular about, there's a problem with the terminology employed by individuals in the media and otherwise about Islam after attacks such as this. I mean, I understand that the word radical or radicalization or Islamic radicalism or Islamic extremism, these phrases are often used. But I think that we need to be quite careful about that. I mean, I know that there are fringe commentators, you know, who may employ those. I mean, I think the other day Ann Coulter, who's, you know, a conservative lightning rod, said something like, you know, because, you know, Tamerlan Tsarnaev's wife wears the hijab, that itself is punished, and she should be punished and put to jail just for wearing the hijab. But what I get nervous about is when very well-respected journalists from mainstream media employ careless and clumsy terminology. For example, Tom Brokaw on Meet the Press said that, you know, Islamic rage hasn't gone away, and this is evidence of it. I mean, the words Islamic rage, I mean, the way I see this is, you know, these gentlemen, their attacks, you know, there were just such a militant perversion of Islam. They're such a departure from Islam. They may be rooted in some aspect of thought from some radical groups who interpret the Quran, but they shouldn't be coupled with the religion itself. And I think people like Tom Brokaw wouldn't be using those phrases if it was a Christian and say Christian rage or Jewish rage. And I think it really does a disservice. So my view is it's very important we scrutinize and understand what happened here, and the influences, the influencers, the enablers, they should be held accountable. But at the same time, we all have a responsibility to sift facts from fiction and make sure we get the story straight and make sure we not, you know, defame an entire faith or make it more difficult for American Muslims to live their faith. I mean, I feel more responsible to stop this type of ideology than I would think anyone else, because, I'm an American Muslim and I'm proud of both being an American and a Muslim. And I feel responsible to try to make sure that the moderates drown out the extremists. But we, you know, everyone goes backwards when mainstream media uses terminology such as Tom Brokaw did, like Islamic rage, or you know, for example, saying things like, CNN analyst, for example, yesterday, I think it was 2 days ago, said that there's an increasing religious radicalization of Tsarnaev. Why? Because he prayed five times a day, and he had allegedly had a beard. Well, that's about 95% of Muslim males pray five times a day and have a beard, or wear a headscarf if you're a woman. So does that make you radical? It's nothing radical about praying five times a day. I did it today. I mean, every Muslim does it.
Sure. Again, I'm speaking with Amjad Mahmoud Khan, who is the National Director of Public Affairs for the Ahmadiyya Muslim Community. He's a frequent lecturer on the Islamic world, human rights, law, and governance, a lawyer based in Los Angeles. He has testified three times before the Tom Lantos Human Rights Commission at the United States House of Representatives about the persecution of religious minorities in the Islamic world. Now, as a journalist, I would like to have a term that I could use. What is the correct term to use in terms of describing this fellow, the older brother in particular, who was possibly, we're not entirely sure, that he was acting in the name of Islam, but he was certainly influenced, apparently, according to his younger brother, speaking yesterday, or writing yesterday, because he can't speak very well, saying that they were really motivated more by the wars against Muslims in Iraq and Afghanistan. So he's at least invoking the cause of Islam.
I think what's important to separate Islam from Muslims, I think there's nothing wrong with calling the individual radical or harboring beliefs that are extreme. But what he's influenced by, if you really probe it deeply, are individuals who purport to claim the mantle of leadership in the Islamic world and project a xenophobic ideology that they claim somehow is rooted in Islam. And he's enabled by that, by the rhetoric, by what is being said about the West. The younger brother said, that really it was the U.S. foreign policy in Iraq and Afghanistan that really upset the individuals to such an extent that they felt like there was a perpetual war. And yes, it is true that possibly, the motivation here is behind what he believes is a deep sense of religious fervor. But that's being projected by certain Muslims who, in my estimation, are perverting Islam. So to use phrases like Islamic extremism or Islamic, radicalism or Islamic rage, I think that's just clumsy. I think it's more important to focus on the individual narratives and speeches and actions of the so-called religious clerics, Muslim clerics, and what they're saying than the faith itself. And that's just my quibble. I mean, I'm not trying to hair split here, but I do feel like words matter, and it really makes it difficult for American Muslims to come out and condemn acts when we have a two-front battle and we're dealing with trying to deal with people who are trying to hijack our faith, but at the same time the mainstream media is putting Islam backwards when we're spending a lot of time explaining basic things like why women wear the headscarf or why we pray five times a day, which is, Islam 101.
Well, what you said earlier, though, Amjad Mahmoud Khan, about how this affects you personally, how when your religion is usurped by these people and it creates the backlash through the failures of the press to frame things correctly. And, of course, there's also the other aspect of Islamophobes in Fox News in particular who have been really saying outrageous things, including the token liberal they have on there, Bob Beckel, and O'Reilly went completely off the deep end last night. You've got Pat Robertson comparing Islam to Nazism, etc. So this is what's going on. But the point that you made, I think, is the key, and that is that no Christian or Jew can dissuade somebody like a Tamerlan from taking this path that he took. The only person that can do that is a moderate Muslim or somebody that can sort of bring him back onto the correct path. And that seems to me that the fact that this affects you personally would indicate to me that as a society, we should be treating people like you as our front line of defense, if you will, in the sense that your and your community are the people that we should be working with to solve this problem as opposed to scapegoating.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, we worked very hard, as Ahmadi Muslims. I mean, our community is one of the oldest communities in America. And, we've worked very hard in not just talking about moderation, but actually, walking the walk. I mean, we've done so many activities in the past, you know, decade, or even, I mean, dating back, you know, a century, really, to try to, you know, overcome this view, you know, this erroneous view that extremism is latent in our faith. I mean, and really, you're right. I mean, moderate Muslims are the solution. And it's not, I mean, I think a lot of American Muslims will say, well, that's what we've been doing for a decade. But, you know, I do take some exception to, you know, an overly defensive posture by the American Muslim community. I mean, I as a civil rights lawyer, human rights lawyer, I understand, I'm keenly aware of rising Islamophobia. I've defended American Muslims in court and civil liberties cases, you know, testified in Congress. But I do feel that that's one aspect of the narrative, and it's not very productive to spend 100% of one's time, you know, claiming that we're victims. I mean, the reality is there is a cancer within this beautiful faith of ours, but perpetrated by a tiny minority of individuals who are quite vocal and influential. And it would be unfair of us to deny that reality. So what are we doing about it? What can we do about it? And my view is it's important to really define, you know, what the faith stands for on key issues and really have some central leadership. Our community is, I think, the one of very few Muslim communities that's united by a single leader. And, you know, he preaches every Friday against extremism. He's done it, you know, for years and years and years. And you know, he's coming shortly here in Los Angeles, you know, in a few weeks, and his first trip to the West Coast. And I'm sure he'll be discussing what he did at Capitol Hill last year and at the European Parliament, that the challenge of extremism is the challenge of our time as Muslims. And we must eradicate extremism, and we do it by actually, you know, in a manner that is a bloodless intellectual struggle to take back our faith from those who perpetrate a very violent view of it. And, you know, the Pakistani Taliban butchered and massacred 86 Ahmadi Muslims in 2010. This was the same group that trained Faisal Shahzad, who was responsible for the attempted, you know, bombing in Times Square. So clearly, you know, the people who are against America are also butchering moderate Muslims. I mean, more Muslims have been killed by quote-unquote, you know, Islamic terrorists than non-Muslims. I mean, so really it comes down to empowering the moderate among us and forging alliances and really taking this insidious evil head on.
Well, given Amjad Mahmoud Khan, that you've testified for the House Human Rights Commission of the U.S. House of Representatives on a number of occasions about the persecution of religious minorities in the Islamic world, give us a sense. You just mentioned your sect being persecuted in Pakistan. The Sufis were also driven out of the Swat Valley and murdered, and hardly a day goes by without the Shia minorities being blown up by Sunni radicals. And what is driving this? And obviously, you have this proxy war, in effect, between the Sunnis and the Shia with Iran versus Saudi Arabia going on. But my understanding is that a lot of what's going on in Pakistan is being fueled and financed by the Saudi Wahhabis, who are, you know, in many ways are very intolerant and seem to consider the Shia worse than heretics.
Yeah, it's a very complicated situation. I mean, I think, as an initial matter, you know, there are 72 different kinds of Muslims. You know, there's incredible complexity and nuance within the larger Islamic world. And, you know, I mean, you know, Muslims are Arabs, Muslims are non-Arabs, you know, Muslims, you know, hail from so many countries, you know, 56 or 58 Muslim countries. And there's just such complexity. And it's important that, you know, voices that are often not projected as mainstream also get heard. And I think what happens is you have, you know, you do have sectarian strife in some Muslim countries, particularly in Pakistan. And it's, you know, I think it's driven largely by, you know, a political worldview, you know, that's enmeshed with the religious state. You know, it's kind of amazing that Pakistan, you know, if, for example, is the only Islamic country in the world that actually has a constitutional amendment that, you know, declares a particular community of Muslims to be non-Muslim. It actually is the only constitution that defines who is or is not a Muslim for purposes of the law, which is fascinating. You know, I mean, it's the idea that a state can define who is or is not a Muslim when that's an intensely personal issue. Really, I think the source of the problem is when statecraft and the constitution actually pick sides as to who is a Muslim and who is not, then everyone suffers from that. That's what's happened to the Ahmadi Muslim community, certainly in Pakistan. That's why my parents fled Pakistan, in the early 70s. That's why it continues to be very difficult for the millions there to exist and live. But I think that the hope here is the next generation of Muslims, the younger generation. I consider myself in that generation at 34, but people who have like-minded understanding, who've grown up and understand universal human rights and values and understand the value of diversity within one's ranks and alternate points of view, that there's a coalition formed among like-minded people who have the energy and passion to really view Muslims in their own ranks, as Muslims if they're self-identifying as such, and focus on what is being said and projected and try to isolate the extreme view. I don't think any American Muslim, was proud of what happened in Boston. I think it's just absolutely tragic. It's heart-wrenching. And it's particularly heart-wrenching to see Zohar, the younger of the two brothers, living this very typical American life, and succeeding and doing well in school, and people are vouching for him, and he didn't spend time abroad, and yet he has devolved because of the influence of his brother. It's a tragedy, and I think it's important that we understand that the tolerance level needs to be very high between and among Muslims and be united in order to fight this cause. And we feel as a community united by a single leader, we have an advantage on that front.
Well, Amjad Mahmood Khan, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Amjad Mahmood Khan, who is the National Director of Public Affairs of the Ahmadiyya Muslim Community. He is a frequent lecturer on the Islamic world, human rights, law and governance, a lawyer based in Los Angeles. He has testified 3 times before the Tom Lantis Human Rights Commission at the United States House of Representatives about the persecution of religious minorities in the Islamic world. And we're going to take a brief station break, and we're back continuing the conversation about Islamophobia with Juan Cole. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Juan Cole, who's a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and president of the Global Americana Institute. He is the author of Sacred Space and Holy War, The Ayatollahs and Democracy in Iraq, Napoleon's Egypt Invading the Middle East, and Engaging the Muslim World. He's also the author of the blog Inform Comment at juancole.com, where he has an article, Terrorism and the Other Religions. Welcome to Background Briefing, Juan Cole.
Thanks so much, Ian.
And in your article, you point out, first of all, that murder rates in most of the Muslim world are very low compared to the United States. But the statistic that really got my attention is that in the 20th century, Muslims killed more than 2 million people or so in political violence. And that was mostly the Iran-Iraq War and the Soviet and post-Soviet wars in Afghanistan, for which the Europeans bear some blame. But you've compared that to a Christian-European tally in the 20th century of about 100 million people. So that in itself is a pretty stark reminder of the pot calling the kettle black.
Yes, well, of course, the piece is, although it's a dark subject, I have to say a little bit tongue-in-cheek. And my point is just that if you mark people by what religious civilization they come from, in this case, European Christianity, and you attribute to their civilization all of the violence they do, then European Christianity looks pretty horrible in the 20th century. And my larger point is that it's nothing to do with Europeans or Christianity or people of European heritage or Christianity as a religion. It so happened that was the part of the world where the Industrial Revolution took place, where nationalism emerged, and people industrialized violence in Europe and in North America before anybody else in the world did. I'm just trying to make an argument that if you go by the numbers, the people, you know, if we had observers from outer space of the human race, and they looked around at who did the most violence and the most harm in the world throughout the last century, it would certainly be people of European and Christian heritage.
And in terms of our last conversation with Ahmad Amjad, who was dealing whose minority sect in Islam has been persecuted, and the idea that the Sunni and Shia are in many ways certainly in Syria, they're at war, and they could be at war in a larger sense at any moment. At least it looks that way. And there's a lot of violence going on in Iraq between Sunni and Shia. How does that compare to European? I suppose the most recent example I come of and it come to. Comes to me from the European context would be in Northern Ireland, the Catholics versus the Protestants. So where does the comparison lie in terms of inter-religious violence?
Oh, well, of course, Christianity has experienced enormous amounts of inter-religious violence, but that has tapered off as Europeans and people of European heritage have especially the past 30 or 40 years, abandoned religion in droves. So that's, you know, that's not the particular issue that roils our civilization for the most part any longer. But, you know, we had in the early modern period, in the 1600s, wars of religion, which polished off hundreds of thousands of people. All religions, you know, have these human beings, you know, play these games of separating themselves out, claiming more status because of certain kinds of beliefs or behaviors, and using violence against their competitors. And they do this whatever situation they're in, whether it's a religious situation or an imperial situation or a national situation. My point is just that, you know, there's a strain of thinking. I get beat off over the head with it a lot, and it is exemplified by some television personalities, that there's something peculiar about Islam. And while it is true that Islam is a religion and Muslims have created civilizations that are distinctive, and they have their own rules of the cultural game, so to speak, there's nothing unique about them. They're just human beings. And once you know the rules that they play with or play by, then their behavior is perfectly understandable as human behavior. And they're not more violent than anybody else, or the religion doesn't teach them to murder people. And all of these things that are being spread about by bigots, frankly, need to be taken on.
Well, certainly Pat Robinson's outbursts on television come to mind in that regard, where he told viewers that Islam is to blame for not only the Boston Marathon bombing but terrorism around the world, he compares Islam to Nazism. And he, of course, represents a religious, if you will, although one can question the religiosity of American fundamentalists, but they consider themselves religious. So from your early remark, Juan Cole, the less secular societies become, the less violent? Is that a conclusion one can take?
Oh, no. Well, the secular people find things to fight about, too. I'm arguing that this part of the human condition, violence, and it can be checked under certain circumstances. I think the major reason for which violence has declined in Europe and North America in the past 50 years is the atomic bomb. Our technology just got to the point where, however much we'd like to deploy violence, the consequences are just too horrible. And so mutual assured destruction kicked in. And if it hadn't been for nuclear weapons, there almost certainly would have been a third world war in the 20th century between the United States and the Soviet Union. And they were spoiling for it. They had all those tanks lined up in Europe. So, you know, it's an artificial situation. There was a Pax Americana. There were nuclear weapons. They couldn't go to conventional war. But they displaced their violence into the third world. So, you know, the United States polished off between 1 million and 2 million, it's not clear, Vietnamese peasants. And there were similar numbers of casualties in the Korean War. And there's been enormous, you know, it's unclear how many people died in the Iraq War, which was a war of choice. It was a war of aggression. So, you know, that people become less religious and more secular. You know, Stalin was secular, but he seems to have been responsible for, again, that's controversial, but 10 million, 11 million, some people say 20 million deaths. So, you know, to single out one-fifth of humankind who happen to belong to the Muslim religion and say, well, those guys are the problem, is just silly if we know the history of human beings in the past 150 years. And, in fact, Muslims have often been at the receiving end. You know, they were subjects of European violence and European conquest and colonialism, which very conveniently now everybody has forgotten about. So the fact that the French, you know, conquered Algeria and ruled it for 122 years and polished off between, you know, 20%, between 5% and 10% of the population towards the end when they tried to get free. This is just not in our consciousness, you know, and there are many such colonial stories. Belgium seems to have killed half of the Congolese that it colonized. I mean, this is a Holocaust. More Congolese died at Belgian hands than Jews died at Nazi hands, and it was a larger proportion of Congolese that were killed than of Jews who were killed by Hitler. So, but nobody remembers that, you know. So the Belgians are not considered peculiarly brutal.
Again, I'm speaking with Juan Cole, who's a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and president of the Global Americana Institute. He's the author of Sacred Space and Holy War, The Ayatollahs and Democracy in Iraq, Napoleon's Egypt, Invading the Middle East, and Engaging the Muslim World. He's also the author of the blog InformComment at JuanCole.com, where he has an article, Terrorism and the Other Religions. So in your article, you just point out how state religion and nationalism have been intertwined, and we're certainly no exceptions there, at least the British, because the Queen is the head of the Church of England, and the Swedish Church is a national church, although I don't think it's particularly strong. You mentioned Franco's role in the Catholic Church during the Civil War. And the examples that we have today, though, of other religions, I mean, people always assume that the Buddhists are just the, you know, into praying and they're incredibly peaceful, which is by and large true. But aren't they involved in a bloody rampage going on now in Burma? So it seems that, you know, I guess the point here is that nobody is without sin in terms of religious violence.
Well, you know, sociologists talk about there being marked and unmarked identities. So there are, you know, people, groups that society is afraid of or marks out for certain kinds of treatment. And these things change over time. In the very earliest 20th century, it was maybe the Poles, because a Pole had assassinated President McKinley, and they were considered, you know, Slavs and maybe socialists and so forth. There are marked identities. So when you say, you know, if a white guy robs a bank in the newspaper, it comes that way, that a bank was robbed, but without mentioning the ethnicity of the person. But if a member of a minority robs a bank, then that ethnicity is mentioned, and that's what we do to Muslims. But for some reason in American society, maybe we don't have very many Buddhists. Buddhists are very nice people on the whole. They're just like everybody else. We don't have so much to do with Sri Lanka or Burma or whatever. We have this maybe romantic vision of the religion. But, you know, in the first half of the 20th century, the Zen Buddhists in Japan were militarists. They supported the generals, Tojo and so forth. And they later apologized for this. They got the country into a lot of trouble. And in Burma today, there's a Buddhist ethnic cleansing campaign against the Rohingya minority. The Buddhist majority in Sri Lanka pursued a war of attrition against the Tamil Tigers, who were, you know, used terrorist tactics. And I'm not defending them, but the things that have come out about the tactics used are quite horrifying. So that Buddhists can be authoritarian and deploy terror and so forth is very clear. And yet that's just not something that our press or our mass media would ever highlight. At least at the moment, you know, things change. But so the spotlight is on the Muslims now. And this is not to deny that there's a movement among Muslims. It's tiny, it's fringe, but it is dangerous and it has some power. But I'm just saying that all any human group that you can identify at some point in recent history has thrown up such groups, and there's nothing peculiar about it. You know, it seems to be that in the transition from a largely rural to a largely urban society, there's a lot of violence involved and deployed. And another possible reason for which things have settled down somewhat in Europe, North America, is that transition's over with, and people are now mostly urban. But, you know, it's very unsettling to have your sureties and your whole lifestyle uprooted and be forced to go to the city, become a factory worker when you've been a farmer or a fisherman. And that's the experience of hundreds of millions of people in the third world at the moment. And politicians seem to be able to batten on these people when they're in transition and they're uprooted and put them to nefarious purposes.
So, Juan Cole, from my point of view as a journalist trying to cover these stories, it is difficult because, for example, during the Boston bombing when it first happened, there was a sort of emerging consensus that it was domestic terrorism. So I talked to people that were specialists on American domestic terrorism, like the Southern Poverty Law Center. Indeed, before that, I spoke to a representative from the Southern Poverty Law Center about the murders down in Texas of the district attorneys, which the suspicion was then that it was the Aryan Brotherhood of Texas. Well, it turned out that it wasn't. It was the wife of a justice of the peace who got fired. She was disgruntled and she murdered these other people who she blamed for her husband being sacked. So it's a sort of object lesson in how you can't get out ahead of yourself here. I don't think I have to apologize to right-wing militias for the coverage of the early days of the Boston bombing. But how – I asked this question of our previous guest. How does one describe this older brother who has invoked Islam, at least the younger brother, not that you can necessarily believe anything these guys say, at least the surviving one. How does one describe him as a terrorist? I mean, what do you think is the fair term, not the politically correct term, but the fair term?
Well, I think that the word terrorist as a term of art, you know, has different meanings. There's a legal definition of terrorism, which is, you know, in the U.S. federal code, actually, terrorism was defined in the 20th century, and the definition is the deployment of violence against civilians by a non-state actor for political purposes. So the government's off the hook in this definition. It's only non-state actors. It's ordinary people. If they use violence against civilians, and apparently this is changing now, but in the older definition in the late 20th century, an attack on soldiers would not be considered terrorism. But if they use violence against civilians for political purposes, then they're terrorists. So I would have to say, Ian, that it's a little bit too soon to know exactly what this guy was up to. And I think it's entirely possible, it could go either way. It's entirely possible that he was hooked up with a network, in which case it's terrorism. It's also possible that he was a nutcase. His father said when he went to Dagestan, he wasn't involved in terrorism there. He slept most of the day. He got up at 3 in the afternoon. His father asked him, did you come here to sleep?
Right. Well, the aunt refuted that. That she said he was out and about doing stuff. So,
well, he could have been out and about doing stuff later in the day. But my point is, people who sleep till 3 p.m. very often are clinically depressed. The neighbors say that he and his wife are, holding these huge rows with each other. He seems to have been angry. I'm perfectly open to the possibility and maybe even the probability that he's hooked up with the network. But it's also possible that he was just mental, that he was clinically depressed and had paranoid tendencies, was full of anger. And, when white guys get like that and they go off on people and go get an automatic weapon and shoot people up, they're almost never called terrorists. And even if they've got links to supremacist groups or violent groups, so there is a little bit of invidiousness here. All I'm saying is I think it's a little bit too early to know exactly how to categorize this guy.
Well, it's definitely a bit of a minefield, just in closing, then Juan Cole, do you think that there will be an adult conversation in this country about asymmetrical warfare, the threats that we face, the blowback? If you take these guys at their word. It has a lot to do with, at least they say, claim it's they're defending Muslims that we've killed in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we do have this drone program that enrages people, and it's a state sanctioned form of assassination. So, what's your sense of the future going forward, that we may have more of these incidents?
Well, I think we probably will have more of the incidents, unfortunately, just as we will continue to have, movie theaters shot up by people with automatic weapons. Modern society and modern technology are a little bit frightening in the sense that each individual is now very powerful. And so a single individual can build a kind of bomb that only a state would have had 150 years ago. We live in a parlous time in that regard. But I'd just like to point out that this guy was thrown out of his mosque in Boston for being an extremist, for standing up and denouncing the preacher for praising Martin Luther King. And that the two guys who were just arrested in Canada for plotting against a train were turned in by the religious preacher in their mosque. I just want to underline that the Muslim community in North America suffers from this as much or more than anybody, and they are showing signs of a real vigilance and help to all of us.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Juan Cole.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Juan Cole. He's a professor of modern Middle East and South Asian history at the University of Michigan. He's the president of the Global Americana Institute and the author of Sacred Space and Holy War, The Ayatollahs and Democracy in Iraq, Napoleon's Egypt Invading the Middle East, and Engaging the Muslim World. He's also the author of the blog Informed Comment at juancole.com, where he has an article, Terrorism and the Other Religions. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about the sweatshop accident killing probably up to 100 people, a series of accidents in Bangladesh.
Messages, victims, and Christians both drinking blood, and they'll pray for the destruction of all hatred, more often just those with hate for us. 'Cause it hurts when you discover one's worse and one's better to suffer or cause others to. And you can live by your conscience. Now guilt is a concept, you know.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Charles Kernaghan, who is the Executive Director of the Institute for Global Labor and Human Rights. He is the principal writer of the Institute's reports and has worked closely with key congressional committees with human rights conditions and oversight responsibilities for U.S. funding for free trade partners. He is recognized as one of the best-known speakers in the country on sweatshops, workers' rights, and globalization, and his work is credited as having launched the anti-sweatshop movement in the United States. Welcome to Background Briefing, Charles Kernaghan.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
And this latest of a series of accidents in garment factories in Bangladesh, which is the world's second leading garment exporters, they're saying now 87 people have been killed, up to 1,000 injured. Maybe the figure will go up further in terms of those that have killed. But there was a fatal accident just 5 months ago, a fire at another factory that killed 112 garment workers. So this appears to be sort of systemic. And at the same time, the big retailers who sell these garments, Walmart, Sears, Gap, Tommy Hilfiger, and others let me ask you, what is their responsibility here?
Well, it's enormous. They just don't take any responsibility. Right now, 130 workers are known dead. That number is going to go up. There's 500 to 600 workers are trapped inside the factory now. It could take days to free them. This is an enormous disaster, which is completely needless. The workers came to work on Tuesday morning, on the 23rd, and with their own eyes, they saw the building was cracked. There was a fissure that was about a foot wide and 10 to 12 feet long. Nobody in their right mind would go into a building like that. It was an eight-story building. There was illegally five stories built on top of the three-story permit that they had. But the workers then did not go into the factory. The factory was padlocked. They came back on Wednesday, on the 24th, and they were met by some of the garment owners and the owners of the housing complex there. And they told the workers, they said, look, we have to get these garments out or else we're not going to get paid for the whole month of April. Now, you can do what you want. You cannot go into the factory. Well, in that case, you're not going to get any of your wages for April. On the other hand, you can go into the factory because we're telling you it's safe, and you'll get into that factory. You will make these goods, and you'll get your pay. And so the workers had no choice. They could not go without 1 month's wages. They live from hand to mouth. So they filed back into the factories, and it took only 1 hour. They went in at 8 o'clock. By 9 o'clock, the factory collapsed, and it's just it's a very deadly situation. These deaths in this factory in the Rana Plaza may exceed any other fire incidences or collapses.
And in Bangladesh, they have the lowest labor costs in the world, I understand, with a minimum wage in the garment industry set at roughly $37 a month. So what are the figures on the kind of profits that these retailers like Walmart and Sears and Gap and Tommy Hilfiger and others who get their clothes from these sweatshops? What kind of money we're talking about here in terms of the wages that the people who make the garments get, and the profits that the brands sell them at over here?
Yeah, it's actually criminal. In this particular factory, to be very specific, the workers work 13 to 14 and a half hours a day, 7 days a week, from 8 o'clock in the morning until 9 or 10:30. The helpers get 12 cents an hour. Junior sewers get 22 cents an hour. And the most senior workers, senior sewers, they get 26 cents an hour. In other words, they live at the edge of starvation. There's no savings. There's nothing. Now, when you talk about the big labels like Walmart and other companies, you're really talking about garments that in the labor cost for the garment could be anywhere from 8 cents, 8 cents, 10 cents, 11 cents. That's what they pay to assemble these garments. So the markups are enormous. We found Nike pricing documents in the Dominican Republic a couple of years ago, and we had all of their Nike's documents on the cost of making these sweatshirts. And lo and behold, the sweatshirts sold for $22.99. And the workers' wages for the entire sewing of these sweatshirts came to 8 cents, which meant that the labor cost was 0.3% of the retail price. So there's enormous markups. And the workers, of course, in this particular incident in Bangladesh, these workers, they just live on the edge of starvation. They live in miserable hovels. That you wouldn't put lawn furniture in, you'd revolt. I mean, it's miserable housing, and it's so crowded, and the workers work these long hours, like I said, 14 and a half hours, often 7 days a week. I mean, it really is criminal, but this is a conspiracy almost between the giant retailers, like the Walmarts, like the Gaps, like others. It's not only them, but it's also the government is corrupt. There's no rule of law. The owner of the Tazreen factory that burnt on November 24th of 2012, 100 workers were burnt to death. The owner's scot-free. Delwar Hussein, he's walking around scot-free. They don't put a finger on him after killing 112 workers. Well, this factory, right now, and it's going to go up, is what we heard as of Bangladesh time last night, 130 workers were dead. Now, it could go way above this, and I can guarantee that the owner of the Rana Plaza, Mr. Rana, he's going to walk around scot-free. No one's going to put a finger on him.
So tell me that, Charles Cunningham, the Executive Director of the Institute for Global Labor and Human Rights, tell me about what you're doing here in launching the anti-sweatshop movement in the United States. What are you trying to do? I mean, I get it. I understand what you're trying to do, but give us an idea of your strategy and what people who are sympathetic to what you're trying to do can do.
Well, I mean, in some ways, you have to act as a muckraker and just keep pumping out these reports that are based on what the workers are telling us, what their hours are, what their wages are, how they live. And, of course, we've gone to Bangladesh, many, many, many times, and we've got people on the ground there that we work with. So we're pretty much on top of this. But the combination of miserable poverty, even though they work 14 hours a day, in collusion with the big retailers who don't care about these workers at all, and then a government that is dysfunctional and corrupt, there's almost no way to get out of this. And at some point, there's going to have to be laws. You know, like we can say that you can bring your garments into the United States. We'll buy them. You know, we'll really work together. But you're going to have to treat workers with some laws, legal laws. Under the ILO labor standards, all workers have the right to organize a union. They have the right to no child labor, no forced labor. They have the right to the core labor standards so that the workers have the right to organize and bargain collectively. We always talk about the ILO. We talk about it all the time, but they do nothing. You know, they claim that Bangladesh belongs to the ILO, and the ILO standards are going to cover these workers. It's nonsense. They treat these workers like slaves. And so something has to give. Right now, these corporations, they have enforceable laws to protect their trademarks and their labels. And when we say to them, you know, that sounds reasonable. You have to have laws to protect your trademarks. Can't we have similar laws to protect the rights of the human being who made the garment? These people come back and say, no, they don't have that right because that would be an impediment to free trade. So corporations have, you know, protections for their labels backed up by the ILO, backed up by international, you know, respect for worker rights and for, you know, the rights of the label. They have intellectual property rights and copyright laws. But when it comes to the human being, there is no laws whatsoever to protect them. And as long as we live in this sort of society, very little is going to change. And in fact, it's going to get worse. China is now dumping all of its, you know, a lot of its garment work into Bangladesh. Bangladesh has maybe 4,500 factories, maybe 4 million workers. This is going to, you know, go up to 10 million workers within the next 7 years.
Well, Charles, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Charles Kernaghan, the Executive Director of the Institute for Global Labor and Human Rights. He's the principal writer of the Institute's report, and he's worked closely with congressional committees on human rights conditions, overseeing responsibilities for U.S. funding for free trade partners, and he's credited with launching the anti-sweatshop movement here in the United States. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Nick Guarino. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.